This is The Takeaway for Monday, July 3rd, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening.
I'm asking you, why not investigate something the biggest scandal in American electoral history? 3 to 5 million people voting illegally?
We'll see where we go from here. But right now, the focus that the president has is on putting Americans back to work. It was a comment that he made on a longstanding belief.
That was White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer dancing around a reporter's question back in January of this year, after the president alleged to the public on Twitter and in private on several different occasions to lawmakers that 3 to 5 million people had voted illegally in the 2016 elections, and that that was the reason why he lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton. There's no evidence for any of this. Nevertheless, in May, President Trump established the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. One of the leaders of that commission is former Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach. He sent a letter to all 50 states and the District of Columbia asking for a range of voter information. That included birth dates, felony conviction records, and the last four digits of Social Security numbers of voters. The response from states red and blue has not been positive. On Friday, more than 20 states were unwilling to fully or partially comply with that information request from the White House. Denise Merrill is Secretary of State in Connecticut, and John Houston is Secretary of State in Ohio. Both of these states have said that they would provide limited information to the White House Voter Commission, despite refusals from other states, and they both join me now. Denise Merrill, John Houston, welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Great to be with you.
Denise Merrill in Connecticut, let me start with you. Is there any evidence of widespread voter fraud in your state?
No, I use that advisedly because you say widespread. Do we have occasional complaints and examples? Yes, we do. And they are prosecuted. And we have had occasional situations where it was actually proven, but it's very, very rare.
So in this case, did I have the list right from the White House of what they asked for? Social Security digits, birth dates, felony records. Is that what they asked for? And what did you agree to send?
Well, I haven't agreed to send anything yet. Yes, they asked for a very broad list of things. And I think the reason you've seen this buzzsaw of protest from the secretaries is that it is a very broad list. And there are various rules in different states about what exactly is publicly available. And actually, the public has yet to understand that any of this is public. And I have had a storm of protest from my constituents about not sending any of their private data to anyone. So I think it's a confluence of things that have happened here. And the commission just sort of stepped into it.
So in that case, Denise Merrill, does that mean that you are willing to send information that's already publicly available?
Well, I'm not sure. It's a complicated question. We have certain protected classes of people. For example, we have a program called Safe at Home, where data, even if they're on the voter list, victims of domestic violence are protected. I don't have the confidence that this commission, whose authority I question, frankly, to get this information, is I'm not sure I'm going to release anything until I'm sure that it could be protected. And so I'm still under legal advisement on this question.
John Houston, you're there in Ohio. Is there evidence that voter fraud is widespread in your state?
I say this about voter fraud in Ohio. It exists. It's rare. And we catch people. We hold them accountable. We conduct, after every general election, a report on voter suppression and voter fraud. We found a few thousand cases over the course of 6 years of voter irregularities, including non-citizens on the voter rolls, non-citizens who voted, people who've attempted to vote multiple times, people who voted in Ohio and other states. But this is out of, you know, millions and millions of voters. And so, you know, we have voter fraud, but we have a pretty good system to catch people and we prosecute them.
Well, John, are you hearing similar concerns from Ohioans that Denise is hearing in Connecticut about the broadness of this request? And what have you agreed to send?
Well, looking at the letter right now from the Presidential Commission, and it asks for publicly available information. And Denise's point was made, well made, is that different states have different laws on what's public information. And in Ohio, most of your voting records are public information. The media can request them. Campaigns can request them. Local activists could request this information. What we will not provide, because it's not public information, is the last four of your Social Security number or your driver's license number. But I think one of the, you know, a lack of familiarity with how our voting systems work and the fact that they're all different in 50 states is a component for confusion and perhaps a little bit of unease about this, because in most places, a lot of this information is already publicly available. You could go to our website today and find most of it.
John, claims of voter fraud or the danger of it have been used to justify voter ID laws and voter restrictions in GOP-led states all over the country in the last few years. We've seen rulings in several states, including North Carolina in particular, where a court struck down voter ID laws, saying they were designed with almost surgical precision to discourage minorities from voting. If there's no evidence of problematic or widespread voter fraud in your state, are you worried about participating in an exercise that's veiled disenfranchisement?
Well, look, how much voter fraud should one tolerate? Because it does exist. The question is, should you put up an unreasonable barrier? And what the definition of unreasonable is where this debate, I think, differs from state to state. So I think building a system of ID or identification process that builds confidence in our voting system is great, but we shouldn't do something that becomes a barrier to access for people. It's finding that middle ground, which I believe we've done in Ohio, and we have not gone for a more restrictive voter ID law, which has occurred in other states.
Denise Merrill, you're in Connecticut, but one of your counterparts in Mississippi named Delbert Hoseman, the Secretary of State there, urged this White House Voter Fraud Commission to go jump in the Gulf of Mexico. Those were his words about this request. Do you have some sympathy for that? And why would somebody situated like you in a state like Mississippi or anywhere else feel that way about this request from Chris Kobach and the Voter Commission?
Well, I think you're hearing it from both John and I that secretaries of state feel they are responsible for free and fair elections in their respective states. And federal interference in elections is a very serious thing. And that's why I think you've seen the reaction you've seen. It's a separation of powers question. And so whenever you get any kind of federal request or interference or something that looks like they're trying to create some sort of centralized federal list, you're going to get a lot of pushback from the states.
And Denise, at the same time, we heard from testimony in front of Senate committees over the last few weeks that more than 20 states, 25 states were the targets of hacking during the election that may have been led by Russian intelligence forces. First of all, is Connecticut one of them? And is that a concern that you think is more pressing than voter fraud in your state?
Yeah, absolutely. And when you talk about the attacks on voting systems, it's the voter lists you're talking about. That's the only thing that's online, because all of the voting systems themselves, if you call it that, the vote tallying machines are not online anywhere in the country. So whenever you're talking about hacking, you're talking about hacking into the voter rolls. And yes, there is strong evidence that foreign countries and others, all kinds of people, were trying to get through our firewalls in all our states. Now, none of it really worked, except I think in two states, Arizona and Illinois, they did breach the firewalls. There's no evidence whatsoever that anything was changed. But the interference in our elections is a very serious matter. And yes, I do think that's a much more pressing matter. And I wish this commission would take that on as a charge rather than trying to find fraud that is pretty much already being dealt with, as you heard from both of us, in our respective states. And I think that's pretty typical across the country.
John Husted, what about you? Was Ohio a target of the hacking that we've heard reported in the Senate committees? And was any information breached?
Our systems in Ohio were not touched by any of the hacking incidents. We were in daily contact with Homeland Security, the FBI, our National Guard cybersecurity unit to make sure that our system, it was in good a shape as it possibly could be. We did not have any issues, but in the letter, the Presidential Commission is asking for our ideas on how we can improve our system of elections in the country, and I will come back with ideas to them. First off, many states, many places, and many states are in need of new machines. Machines and our computer technology, the newer it is, the less vulnerable it is to hacking. So if the federal government would like to provide some resources to the states so that they could update their technology, that would be a helpful thing. But I don't want federal intervention in the state's elections, and that's why I will provide only what's publicly available. We don't want the federal government any more involved in our elections than they already are.
At the same time, there's a bottom line here, John, and Denise, I'll ask you this too, that I wonder if it's come up for discussion on your staff. There seems to be a risk here that you're being asked to spend your time and your state's money on an effort born almost entirely from one of the president's false claims, that claim that 3 to 5 million people voted illegally, and that's why he lost the popular vote. That is the genesis of this entire commission, is it not? Is that a concern that you have, John?
Well, I think, you know, when you ask for people to look into something like this, sometimes you might not like the answer that you get. And this is not going to take any extra time for us, because literally everything they ask for is already available right on our website. We'll just direct them to where they need to go to get it. But a lot of times on the political right or the political left, there's a narrative about what happens in elections that harms their particular cause. And I think a lot of times the facts don't support either of those worldviews. And I think in this case that the facts will show that, yes, voter fraud exists. It's rare, and most states, if not every state, has a process in place to try to prevent it.
Denise Merrill?
Well, just the fact that we're spending so much time on this shows you that it's very, overemphasized would be a polite word for it. It's really, in my view, a witch hunt. And, you know, so you happen to be talking here to two people who have, I think, appropriate ID laws in their states. Mine is very similar to the one in Ohio, where there's a variety of things you can use to identify yourself. But very clearly, these barriers are being put up for specific purposes. And that's what worries me. It's not that it's not reasonable to ask whether we can find and root out fraud where it exists. I think we're already doing that, frankly. But the extent of this is the problem. I think this commission ought to refocus on the real threat, which I really think is to our new cyber systems. And yes, I totally agree with John. We need more resources. The states are short when it comes to having systems that are able to withstand some of these cyber attacks, and they're going to continue. This time, we've been good. We've been working with DHS. We've been working with the FBI, and so have most of the other states who are under question. So let's talk about what really is a problem and get moving on that.
Two states dealing with requests for voter information from the White House Voter Fraud Commission, Denise Merrill, Secretary of State in Connecticut, and John Husted, Secretary of State in Ohio. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. A deadline has passed in Qatar where several neighboring states are trying to force the hand of the small Persian Gulf nation. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bahrain, and other countries, they all say Qatar is funding criticism of their governments and is too close to Iran. Those countries gave Qatar until last night to meet 13 demands. And that deadline has now been extended by just 2 days. But meanwhile, the threats are flying. The United States has deep interests, not only in the Middle East, but in Qatar itself. There's a large and vital U.S. military base there. And President Trump and the Secretary of State don't seem to agree on what to do about it. Renda Sleem is a director at the Middle East Institute, and she joins me now with the latest. Renda, welcome.
Good to be with you, Todd.
What were some of the most important of these 13 demands that Qatar's neighbors have made on it here?
There are three sets of demand. The first one is for Qatar to stop supporting and expelling leaders of Islamist groups that are in Qatar or supporting them overseas. And that includes the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas. The second set of demand has to do with Qatar stopping to provide a platform for critics of the governments in Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bahrain, Egypt on its media outlets, specifically Al Jazeera. And the third set of demand is for Qatar to downgrade and scale back its diplomatic engagement with Iran.
So we're approaching this deadline that's coming earlier this week. Is Qatar moving to meet any of these demands?
The Qatari foreign minister said yesterday that these are demands that are not meant to be met. On the other hand, you hear the Saudi foreign minister saying these are non-negotiable demands. Both sides of this dispute are still stuck in maximalist positions. At some point, there needs to be a common ground created somewhere in the middle. We are not close to that stage.
It doesn't seem, Renda Sleem, like any of those alleged behaviors by the Qatari government are new. I wonder what has led to this moment where Egypt and Saudi Arabia and other countries have chosen this moment for an isolation and a crackdown.
I think this has been in the making for some time. So this, as you well noted, these are not new demands. And in the past, those similar demands were made of Qatar, and Qatar made small concessions to meet those demands. Like in the past, for example, Qatar shut down the Egypt-based branch of Al Jazeera, Misr Mubashar, in reply to a similar set of demands about Al Jazeera. That was in 2009.
One of the things that did change here, it seems, in this long simmering dispute was that the president of the United States took a side right after he visited Saudi Arabia on an official visit. He took to Twitter. He seemed to agree with the isolation of Qatar. What was behind that timing, do you think, and has it changed the balance here?
Well, there have been two changes also. So on one hand, you have the White House taking sides. You did not see the same behavior from the State Department. The State Department, in fact, trying, especially Secretary Tillerson, trying to, you know, push for a solution, negotiate a solution, and push the different sides to reach a negotiated solution. The other change, I think, has been the change in leadership in Saudi Arabia with the appointment of the deputy crown prince to the crown prince now. And he's a young leader, and he's eager to assert Saudi leadership and authority of the region. And he feels, by the way, he feels emboldened by the statements coming out of the White House, especially the president of the United States. And so these two developments have pushed, especially the Emirati, Saudi, Egyptian, Bahraini side, to dig in and to make these kind of extremist demands on Qatar.
At the same time, Renda Sleem, people will remember that there are several very important military bases in Qatar. Turkey has one. They've been sending in equipment as this crisis escalates. And of course, the United States has a large base with 11,000 troops. Is there any danger that this confrontation escalates?
There is always a danger of conflicts like these to escalate. However, I don't see, as of now, any interest on any sides in this dispute, be it the Emirati Saudis on one side, the Qataris on the other side, to militarize this dispute. So I think we're going to see, in reaction to the no by Qatar, the no answer most likely by Qatar, we're going to see ratcheting up of sanctions. You are going to see maybe Saudis and Emiratis basically asking companies around the world, asking countries around the world to take sides. And it's going to be tough on companies that have large investments and large businesses with Saudi and Emirati, as well as with Qatar, to choose sides. But I think that's where we are heading.
Several analysts have said that there's really only one government that can mediate this dispute effectively, and it's the United States. And I wonder, with the disagreement apparently between President Trump, who's taken a side here, and the State Department, who's taken a different side, whether the United States is equipped to help solve this problem.
I think we should not lead the mediation effort, partly because of the differences in perspectives between the different organs of the U.S. government about the tack to take in this crisis. But it's important also that the face of the mediator be an Arab, and particularly an Arab leader from the Gulf. There is a mediation effort by the Emir of Kuwait. The last crisis between the same sides were mediated successfully by the Emir of Kuwait, but it took months, and we are still less than a month from the beginning of this crisis.
Renda Sleem, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Renda Sleem is a director at the Middle East Institute. A two-year civil war in Yemen is at the root of a disastrous cholera epidemic that's said to be the worst in the world, according to international health authorities. There are now around 250,000 reported cases of cholera, with thousands of new cases being identified daily. More than 1,500 people have already died, many of them children. Michelle Geyer is the Emergency Health Director for the International Rescue Committee. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you very much, Todd.
How is cholera spread?
So cholera is a bacterial infection, and it's spread through people's feces, which infect basically drinking water. And so in very poor conditions where you've got lack of safe water and sanitation, you will tend to have this spread very, very quickly. The other issue is when people are malnourished, and as you know, 7 million people in Yemen right now are food insecure. What it does is that makes you very, very vulnerable to any form of disease, but it also makes that disease much more severe in you. So this is why we're getting so many deaths and so many cases, I believe. Between malnutrition and death is essentially disease. And as you said, many of these deaths have been in children. About 25% of the deaths have been in kids. And just you're weaker, you're vulnerable, you're going to die. The other issue is, you know, this outbreak started back in October. We really believe that, you know, a lot of the issues that are related to the conflict have caused it. We've had massive, massive disruption in infrastructure, destruction of water and sanitation infrastructure, destruction of hospitals. This is not the way that, you know, you can stop a disease from spreading. We are told that 14.5 million people are lacking safe water and sanitation in this country. Now, without that, how do you hope to get clean water, and how do you hope to stop this outbreak from spreading?
Michelle Geyer, you mentioned the fatal interaction between cholera and hunger, and behind all this, the conflict, the war in Yemen that's been ongoing. Talk a little bit more about the interaction between those three factors and how it may be making it difficult not only for people to avoid disease, but for aid to get to them.
Okay, so we've had a conflict for over 2 years now. The conflict's had a heavy, heavy toll on the country and its population. So first of all, in terms of destruction of infrastructure, so destroying water and sanitation infrastructure, that means you just can't provide clean water and sanitation facilities. And 14.5 million people in the country don't have access to safe drinking water or sanitation. When you destroy hospitals, or with active conflict, it's very hard to access healthcare. The other aspect of the conflict is that there have been massive fuel and food shortages. This means that you can't actually run generators to not only pump your water around or to even provide facilities at the hospitals. So the conflict has really, really dilapidated the country, really destroyed its infrastructure, public infrastructure, which means many people are at risk because they just don't have access to safe water and sanitation.
Michelle Geyer, the UN Humanitarian Commission called this a man-made catastrophe. You've made that case. Have the warring sides in Yemen, the Saudis, the Yemeni government, rebel factions, have any of them agreed to step back enough to allow aid organizations to get through to at least try to avoid instant deaths from cholera?
I mean, as an aid agency, we, you know, don't get into the politics of the different warring parties, and we really rely on the UN interlocutors to do their job. All we are asking for is for this poor population to be granted some peace once and for all. They've suffered so much. There was already poverty and insecurity in this country. It's only been made worse now that they're all malnourished, and now we have disease. We really just need people to stop this conflict once and for all.
Michelle Geyer with the International Rescue Committee, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Peter.
Yemen isn't the only country on the brink of famine. Back in March, a senior UN official delivered a dire warning to the Security Council in New York.
We are facing the largest humanitarian crisis since the creation of the United Nations. Now, more than 20 million people across four countries face starvation and famine. Without collective and coordinated global efforts, people will simply starve to death.
That's the UN's humanitarian chief, Stephen O'Brien. O'Brien said it's possible to avoid catastrophes in Yemen, South Sudan, Somalia, and Northeast Nigeria. But he also said that would take $4 billion by July. That money has been slow in coming from donor nations. That's according to David Beasley. He's executive director of the UN World Food Program. Beasley is a former Republican governor of South Carolina, and I spoke to him as he was in Berlin, Germany, for some high-level meetings on this very issue.
One of the biggest problems today is that the crises have gone to unbelievable proportions. I mean, just last year, we were dealing with 80 million people going without food and needing assistance. And this year, we've gone up from 80 to 108 million. But the crises have gotten so much more complicated. You're dealing with protracted man-made conflicts like in Yemen, South Sudan, Somalia, Syria, Iraq, and the list goes on. And the also, and this is the difficult thing, there's so many distractions around the world today, like political issues such as Brexit or the Le Pen in France or the phenomena that the media seems to be obsessed with in the United States on Trump. And so that distracts from some very critical issues like dying children. And this is the message I'm trying to get out, how serious this situation is. For example, in the four countries facing famine, we're talking about in the next 3 to 4 months, if we do not receive the funds we need, 600,000 children literally dying. And this is a horrible situation. And so we need to get the word out. But I will say that the United States has been stepping up, and I expect the United States to continue to step up in an admirable way. Germany has been extraordinary, and the European Union is also stepping up. But there are countries that are not doing, in my opinion, what they should be doing.
Now, at the same time, Governor, you say the United States is stepping up, and we do give proportionally a lot of money. But there has been criticism that getting the money to flow from the bureaucracy in Washington has been painfully slow, especially because so many positions within the State Department and USAID have not been filled by the Trump administration, and that's having a real effect on the dollars.
Well, the United States government and the United States people historically have provided the moral leadership on humanitarian assistance. And I don't think at this stage of the game, the United States is going to back down. We have been meeting with the White House, with State Department, as well as other government officials in the United States Senate and the House. And I think the United States will continue to stand strong, still be the world leader in humanitarian assistance. And I can tell you, I'm confident that the United States will provide the funds necessary and on time.
And yet the budget from this White House, from the Trump White House, proposes a $1 billion cut in food aid. Congress may not go along, but that's a pretty drastic shift in the priorities that you're talking about.
With regards to President Trump, I have little doubt once he receives sufficient information as to this matter, he will fully support and be a leader as to humanitarian aid, because it is in the United States national security interest to fully fund humanitarian assistance. Because if you don't, it's not just children die, but also it becomes a bad situation for terrorism and extremism. And so I am confident that the United States Senate and the United States House will stand strong, and I'm confident that the President of the United States will also be a leader in this issue. And I'm hoping, and I am very confidently hopeful that we'll see leadership from the President soon.
David Beasley is Executive Director of the UN World Food Program and also former Republican Governor of South Carolina. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. And we want to spend the last part of the show today with another installment of our series, Uncomfortable Truths Confronting Race in America. We've been running this series for several months now and asking you to nominate yourselves to take part in some difficult but honest discussions about race. Rochelle Shimke heard that call out on the air, and she wrote to us. Rochelle grew up in the 60s on a farm in a very small white community in Tacoma, Washington. Her parents are white, like Rochelle, but she has two adopted brothers, Norton, who was adopted from South Korea, and her brother Garrett, who is black. Rochelle wrote to us, "I would love to have a conversation with my brother about how we both grew up in the same land, but maybe saw completely different landscapes." So we invited Rochelle and Garrett to sit down and talk about their upbringing and how it's informed the way they perceive race in America today.
I have to confess that I did not see our family as different until just recently. I guess I had never thought of my brothers as a different color.
Yeah, same here. I mean, within a, what I would always exaggerate and say, within a 100-mile radius, Norton and I were it for everybody. There wasn't Latin or Asian or anything else. It was just us and everyone else. Mm-hmm. However, that was for me, I can only speak for myself, not Norton, my norm. So even though I could look and see that I was with a family of blonde hair, blue eyed, 8 foot tall people, that was my normal. So I didn't grow up seeing that as meaning that I was different from them. It wasn't until I was old enough for people to see and say, "Hey, how come you don't look like your parents?" From which then I took a leaf out of my dad's book and would make up an embellished story and say, "Well, back in the day, you know, the slave trade, it's a recessive gene," and I just kind of popped out. I mean, wow. I would say things like that because I'm politically very incorrect. Yeah, I told my friends that. I said, it just came out. And dad was behind me once when I told somebody that, and he gave me a little high five. He was like, "Way to go, son."
Dude, I never heard that. So when do you think, Garrett, that you realized that you and Norton and all of us were all different colors?
Well, it's kind of like I knew, but that didn't register as being anything but normal. It wasn't till I didn't see that it was not normal until probably junior high when now we're out of the rural area. We're into school with more observers, so to speak, that can comment and notice that we're so different.
At Keithley Junior High.
Yeah. And that's what I think is so incredible is by all statistics, I should have had a really tough time in a rural farming community as the only black child for miles in the 60s. But I didn't feel that. And even to people then, if I were to ever say, "I am a black child," which isn't bad, but is kind of a comment of separation, like, "I am black," meaning I'm different than you, that would have probably struck them as a little strange. Like, "Well, I didn't know that," because people just saw you, me, as part of the community.
Right.
And there were occasions when we went into really small restaurants in the rural towns, and I could tell everyone sort of turned their heads and looked, and I thought, well, maybe it's because of me, but the thing about that is I never let that own my definition.
Okay.
I knew why they were possibly staring, but I didn't go into places thinking they're going to stare, they're going to hate, they're going to treat me differently.
Oh, God.
I recognized when it happened. I never really had any confrontations growing up, racially speaking. Really, the only confrontations I ever had with anyone was always people who looked like me. Because I was different from them, possibly the way that I talked or the fact that I play banjo and like bluegrass music and were doing things that stereotypically weren't black enough.
Wow.
But from white people growing up in this rural farm town where I should have probably most likely have had that experience, I didn't have that.
So moving forward like by 20, 30 years. So you and I got to hang out when you became a cosmetologist and you had your salon in Bellevue. I was shocked to hear during one of our chats about how what you just mentioned, that you felt racism from black people to you. And not in King County from white people to you.
Yeah, that's the part that I want to tread lightly on. It is uncomfortable.
Oh, okay.
But that's the type of racism that I've always received is that I don't come across black enough, whatever that is.
Wow.
That and then the other one saying you're the whitest black man that I've ever met. I get that all the time.
Dang.
And it's a shame that if you speak like I do, whatever that is, if you listen to music that is outside of the urban or rap or what have you, that somehow that means you're not something rather than you're taking the opportunity to think, I'm an American, so all these music types, all these cultures, all these things belong to all of us. So why not open your box more, grab as much as you can rather than live in this small box that says you can only do these certain things or otherwise you're not representing your people well enough. And that's in all cultures, I think, to some degree.
You have white women that used to come to your salon. And I think I asked you once why you never had women of color or black women in your salon. Do you remember that conversation? Do you remember that question? Oh, no. So in your response to me was...
Okay. So for one, I did grow up in a white family, partially Korean. My hair was straight growing up, so I only had experience with that. And black hair is something culturally that typically you have your black salons because there's a lot more to the whole process, which I don't know myself because I went to a beauty school, which some would call a white beauty school, where you have 30 seconds with a mannequin with Afro black hair and someone's picking it out going, all right, you just got to pick it out a little bit. And then there's more education that needs to be known about doing black hair. So people would see me cutting hair in the salon and assume, oh, he's an expert. I'm going to ask for him. Because the question a lot of black women will ask when they go to a salon that they don't know or haven't gone to is, do they know how to do black hair? That is a very common question because you do need to know. It's different than everyone else's. And I wasn't taught that. I didn't grow up with it. Then the look of disappointment and disgust at me is, how could you be a black man and not know how to do your own people's hair? And that's very hard to have that conversation and to have to admit that. But on the other side, why do you assume that the white woman next to me doesn't know how to do your hair? She happens to be the expert in this whole salon. She puts in a lot of time. She went to a school that taught her. You're assuming she doesn't, and you're assuming I do. That's a double racist assumption in that part. But no one ever calls that out.
We just heard how Garrett never really considered himself to be a minority. He felt like he was part of the family and the larger community. But when he left that community and went just a few miles south to Cedro Woolley, all of a sudden he wasn't one of the Shimkey kids. He was black.
So Cedro Woolley is a little small town, as both of us know, kind of rural, just like more or less where we grew up on 32nd Avenue. And people have always been really friendly, maybe because it's also a farming town or rural town. That is not the experience that you have. And when you shared your story, I was sick to my stomach, So can you please share again what happened with you going through Cedro Woolley?
So Tiff and I used to live in Bellingham. And in the month of August, I would ride my bike from Bellingham to Seattle or Bellingham to Bellevue or reverse just to give myself a little challenge on a bike. And every time, strangely enough, and see, and I don't go into places looking for this or expecting this, so that's why this is so different from anything else I've ever encountered in my life. The minute I crossed into the border of Cedro Woolley on either side, either going to the south end or coming from the south end to the north, there was a truckload of white kids that just found me and would drive by, pass me, and then yell out the window the N-word, and then just keep going. So it happened three times, and so finally I came with another route that went around Chuckanut Drive the long way around because I didn't want to go through Cedro Woolley. It was a little odd. It was almost like they were waiting there for somebody different to come through and do it. Now, I don't know if that represents, and I doubt it does, all of Cedro Woolley. It just happened to be along Highway 9 that coming in and out, these groups of kids saw me and chased me down in a truck. But I honestly don't care, because as long as it doesn't hurt me and they go on their way, it is just them screaming out a window. It's unsettling. But in the end, if that's all they have in them and that's all they're going to do, I don't need to change them as long as I get from point A to B unharmed.
It's horrifying for me that my beautiful brother, who I love with my life and with my heart, has been treated in horrible racist fashions that I had no idea was going on.
But see, if you think of it this way, I mean, and I appreciate that, But considering how great of a life I had, if I had to do it all over again, I would choose the exact same path. Growing up in Tacoma, wow. Puyallup,
wow.
In a rural town with the community from which we lived, it was fantastic because most of all, it allowed me to be my own person.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, there might have been a few instances where that kind of thing happened, but really not until I was an adult.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a pretty safeguarded experience. Sure, people may have stared at me sometimes who had never seen a brown boy walking around, but that doesn't break me. Mm-hmm. And we all have struggles of our own, correct?
Oh, God.
But it's the greater of it all, and that is I grew up an individual, a supported individual, in a beautiful community. I don't care about any of that other stuff. I'm not suffering. Mm-hmm. Sure, a truckload scared me, and they yelled out the N-word, but it doesn't devalue who I am in my own mind. As long as I'm not destroyed or hurt, it really isn't a, wow, he really struggled. Here's a little funny story.
Okay.
And, of course, with the way that I think, only this would happen to me with my naivety. Did you ever realize that I inadvertently dressed up as a Klan member for Halloween?
No.
Do you remember when I used to dress up as a ghost? I always wanted to be a ghost, but I always wanted the top to be pointy. And not until I was an adult did I realize, oh, my gosh, I was a Klan member. A black Klan member. Just get a sheet and cut two holes and off you go. Yeah.
That is
I just discovered that years ago. And
really?
Thought, oh, wow. I had no idea what I was doing. Yeah. It was innocent.
Innocent.
Yeah.
Our whole life was so innocent.
It was. You're just not aware.
No, and I'm not.
That's the question I bring to the listeners is my unawareness of those kind of issues. And I grew up happy. Because I wasn't looking for those kind of things. I wasn't thinking of myself as a victim. I wasn't looking to be mistreated. So therefore, I wasn't, even if I was. So what is the harm of that, as opposed to having to prove and find every racist person out there and go up to their face and say, you're a racist and you're mistreating me and you're doing this. I feel great. And I may have missed opportunities to do that if somebody was treating me in a way, just because I'm black, but the fact that I didn't know, didn't care, and went about my business doesn't make me less of a person. I always knew who I was. So why can't that be more of the trend as opposed to always going up and pointing fingers at people and just calling everybody in the world a racist for everything?
Garrett, I wish now in this last couple of years with the person that is in the White House we have now and all the things that have come surfaced, as they say, and the attacks, knife attacks on a Muslim woman and the killing of the man in Kent who happened to be Sikh, and it just makes me ill. What's happening with racism now at the surface and the things that white people are doing against others who don't look like them. I'm pleased to my heart that you did not grow up that way, that we were not treated by any KKK members or anyone in our towns coming at us just because we all happen to look different from one another.
It didn't happen that way. You're right. We didn't have that. But I think that no one's exempt. I think it comes from both ends. We're just putting in the news the white to black end, though. I mean, we're making it so impossible to relate interracially because there's all these terms we have to know, all these identifications, all these politically correct things that if you don't match the exact term that that one individual wants to be called, whether it be black, colored, African-American, or what have you, then you're a racist. So I don't even think we really know what that word means anymore.
Mm.
I mean, it was bad then, and it's now bad the other way now, I think. We need to come back in the middle, and I don't know if that ever will again.
We want to thank Garrett Shimke and his sister, Rochelle Shimke, for sharing their story with us. Well, as we've heard in this conversation and others here on The Takeaway, interracial adoption can be complicated. In a few days, we'll talk with Rebecca Carroll. She's special projects editor at WNYC. And Rebecca will share her story of being adopted by white parents and why she believes race is vital to talk about in these families. Again, that conversation is coming up later this week. And of course, we always want to hear from you. Some of these conversations in our Uncomfortable Truth series are tough, and that's the point. If you agree or disagree, or it made you think or made you want to scream at your radio, let us know. You can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tomorrow on the show, we'll bring you a roundup of some of our Uncomfortable Truths conversations, and we want you to take part. Visit thetakeaway.org/truths. Tell us how you could bridge racial divides in your world by having a conversation with anyone of your choosing. It could be a family member, a friend, or a coworker. We'll review that submission, and if we select your story, we'll set up everything to record your conversation. Again, visit us at thetakeaway.org/truths to sign up. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com, by the Arkansas Economic Development Commission, and the state committed to acting quickly and decisively on corporate interests. Learn more about how Arkansas works for businesses at ArkansasEDC.com. By Staples. Staples offers copy and print solutions for businesses, including color copies, presentations, and promotional products. More at Staples stores or at Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.